The headlines this hour. Iran offers its assessment of the European Union's draft proposal to revive the 2015 nuclear agreements, saying that it is now awaiting the U.S. response. The Israeli military acknowledges that its airstrikes resulted in the deaths of five Gaza children, earlier blamed on a stray Palestinian rocket. And a new phase of tensions erupts over Taiwan with China, sanctioning several pro-independence Taiwanese officials. Thanks for joining us. Iran has provided the European Union with its final conclusion on the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement and is now awaiting the U.S. response.
I think that by 12 o'clock tonight, we will submit our final conclusion on the remaining issues between us in writing to the European Union coordinator.
Earlier on Monday, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Tehran would offer its final conclusion on the JCPOA revival talks by midnight local time. He added that Iran sees no obstacle to a revived deal if its red lines are respected. The top diplomat said that Washington must show flexibility and a realistic approach if it wants to restore the nuclear accord known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdollahian said that it would not be the end of the world if the U.S. fails to do so. He warned that Iran has its own plan B if the JCPOA revival talks fail.
They talk about Plan B. We also have our own Plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The Iranian foreign minister made the comments 1 week after the EU put forward what it called a final text on the JCPOA revival, following 4 days of indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran in the Austrian capital. The JCPOA was thrown into chaos after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining parties to the accord have held several rounds of negotiations to restore the deal since last year. Iran's foreign ministry has rejected reports by some Arab media outlets that Tehran is using its southern port to smuggle weapons to Yemen. Spokesman Nasser Kanani says such claims are unfounded and are based on a scenario that has repeatedly been played out by the Saudi-led coalition and its Western backers. The spokesman said Iran's support for the Yemeni people has always been on a political level. Kanani says such accusations are leveled against Iran to divert public attention from the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. He was reacting to Arab media reports that members of a busted Yemeni smuggling cell have testified to Iran's military support for Yemen's Ansarullah movement. The reports quoted the alleged smugglers as saying that Iran's Bandar Abbas is being used for shipment of weapons to Yemen. Both Iran and Ansarullah have denied any transfer of military hardware. Israel has admitted its strikes led to deaths of five Palestinian children on the last day of its latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip. An arms inquiry has confirmed the deaths in an Israeli strike on August 7. The children were aged 3 to 16. The military initially claimed the miners were killed by a misfired rocket by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The three-day Israeli aggression killed 49 Palestinians, including 16 children. The regime ended its strikes after a ceasefire with Islamic Jihad. An Israeli trooper has been shot dead in what the military is calling a friendly fire incident near the city of Tulkarm in the occupied West Bank. The regime's military says the trooper was among those injured when a fellow soldier opened fire on military personnel by mistake. The trooper was in critical condition and later died of his injuries. Initial reports suggested that Palestinian resistance fighters had conducted the attack and that a manhunt was underway for the assailants. But that narrative was retracted hours later. Early this year, a friendly fire incident in the Israeli military left two troopers dead in the occupied West Bank. A correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier to give us more details about the incident.
One Israeli soldier has left his post for a brief period, and then when he returned back, another Israeli soldier in the same location thought it was he was an intruder or a Palestinian coming towards him. So immediately he used his gun to shoot and kill his fellow soldier. This shows that it's very clear Israeli soldiers are quick to pull the trigger. Every time a Palestinian is killed, in many cases, they didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers, but they were killed in cold blood because there are orders for the Israeli soldiers from the military establishment. They have a green light to use their weapons in order to shoot and kill. They are always equipped to pull the trigger.
Several people have been injured in a shooting in occupied East outlets. The gunman targeted passengers on a bus and in nearby cars. The police have not ruled out the possibility of more than one shooter. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups have called the attack a heroic move.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied Old City of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the Old City. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
China has imposed sanctions on several senior Taiwanese officials as tensions are running high between them over Taipei's ties with the U.S. China says the Taiwanese officials will be barred from entering China, Hong Kong, and Macau and making profit in the mainland. Beijing has accused them of supporting Taiwan's independence. It also says the officials have deliberately instigated confrontations across the Taiwan Strait. Tensions between Beijing and Taipei have heightened following a recent visit by a delegation of U.S. lawmakers. The trip came weeks after a controversial trip by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island infuriated Beijing. China considers the island as part of its own territory and has repeatedly warned against its growing ties with the U.S. Russia's president has underscored the importance of military technical cooperation in the emerging multipolar world. And in that spirit, He has expressed Moscow's readiness to sell state-of-the-art weapons to allies globally. Addressing an arms show outside of Moscow, Vladimir Putin insisted Russian weaponry is significantly superior to their foreign counterparts. The Kremlin leader said almost all of the Russian weapons have been used more than once in real combat operations. Putin pointed to Russia's war in Ukraine, saying that Russian forces and their allies are gradually taking control of the eastern Donbas region. He said that Russia has many like-minded allies across the world. Putin stressed that they do not, quote, succumb to the so-called hegemon, and their leaders show a real masculine character and do not capitulate. The Taliban have announced the anniversary of the U.S. shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan after two decades of occupation as a national holiday. In our news review program, we discussed how things have changed in Afghanistan since the Taliban takeover.
Afghanistan is marking the first anniversary of the Taliban's return to power and the chaotic withdrawal of the U.S. following 20 years of occupation. The Taliban have announced Monday a national holiday. Exactly a year ago, Taliban forces captured Kabul following a blitz against government forces. Afghanistan has seen a rise in attacks against the local Shiite population since the Taliban seized power. The country is also facing a humanitarian crisis. Aid agencies saying that half the entire population is struggling with extreme poverty. To make matters worse, the U.S. froze nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets. The U.N. and other international bodies are calling on Washington to release the funds to allow Afghanistan deal with its crises. Now, time now to invite a couple of guests to ask for their information, views, and get some insight. So, Abdullah Mirzada, our correspondent, joining me from Afghan capital Kabul. Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and activist, is joining me from Belfast. Now, let's go to Kabul first. Abdullah, 1 year passes since the Taliban's takeover of power, returning to power, actually. Well, if there has been any change, how things are different in Afghanistan, if they are different, and do we see some change for better or for worse or no change? What's the situation like?
Well, yes, as you know, Mr. Najafi, today, 15th of August, marks the first anniversary of Taliban taking over Kabul again. Well, today we witnessed Taliban forces marching on the streets, playing some ritual musics they love, and taking pictures with people and saying loud words like to celebrate the first anniversary. And to go straightly to the important things, we could refer that people are still saying that economic situation is the first matter that they care about. I mean, there are many people who say that the security situation has changed, it has come to a better place, but still a hungry stomach would care more about food than security. The situation of economy in Afghanistan right now is, as experts say, is like a closed circuit, I mentioned before, and this closed circuit is depreciating day by day. The blockage and the frozenment of assets of Afghanistan has worsened this situation. The amount of money that was in circulation in Afghanistan's economy has decreased by a great amount, and the amount that is circulating in Afghanistan is not enough to simply answer the demands of the nation of Afghanistan.
Okay, you gave us a wide picture of things in Afghanistan. Now, let me ask Fra Hughes in Belfast. Fra, as you just heard, Abdullah mentioned different fields in terms of economy, security, also women's issues. I believe that we also should not forget that, and also the brain drain that was mentioned, and also maybe this is kind of some disorganized, disorderly way. Actually, maybe we can call it mismanagement. So lots of money being funneled to Afghanistan, but we don't know what happens to it. So 20 years of U.S.-led occupation and military presence there. So what did it bring Afghanistan? They left Afghanistan in that way, and simply they left it in disarray, and you see how the situation is like. I mean, what can be done?
Well, America claimed when it invaded Afghanistan that it was there to liberate the people and to liberate the political climate that people lived under. But what it actually did was destroyed and devastated a sovereign nation. For 20 years, it was involved in an illegal, in my perspective, an illegal occupation of a sovereign nation. I'm no fan of the Taliban, but what I will say is that the Taliban are Afghans. The Afghans are now in charge of their own security and their own sovereignty. They are no longer subservient to America and the imperialist West. And I think one of the first things after the occupation of Afghanistan that Hamid Karzai, I think the first kind of presidential order or rule or law that he decreed was to allow a pipeline, a gas pipeline, to travel through Afghanistan. So I believe that the war against the Afghan people was an economic war, was a physical war, it was a violent war, it was an armed war, it was occupation, oppression, and subjugation of the people. And while they destroyed the internal Afghan economy, they also raped the economy by stealing the natural resources of the Afghan people. So 20 years of war must be followed by 20 years of investment. I don't think there's any chance that the Americans are going to release any of the funds that they are illegally sequestering in America, because they are thieves, they are robbers, and they are thugs. And the administration cares nothing for the American people, and it cares nothing for the Afghan people.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Abdullah Mirzada in Kabul, Fra Hughes in Belfast with her insight and contribution.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashful Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizade, an erstwhile student of seminary who left for the U.S. while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called White Revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the U.S., opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Borujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Borujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Borujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion." Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.' Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Borujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces, such as the clergymen and landowners. Ms. Sagafi says, in 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah and Thai religious moves. Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Sagafi, referring to her protest to the imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel the duty?" He answered, "I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent." So I was sure that the imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always tried to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Sagafi narrates as follows. "The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments. Preparation for uprising, the uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, 'If they arrest me, do not be anxious.' I told him jokingly, 'That's good, as I will breathe for a while.' In the advent of his struggles, the imam would tell Ahmad, 'Tonight they may arrest me. Don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.'" This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
As Afghanistan marks a year since its occupiers left the country, in particular the U.S., the country is facing many challenges. Not that it was free of them. Its economic system is in peril, yet the U.S. refuses to give back Afghanistan's government's money to the ruling government, the Taliban. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at U.S.'s disastrous Afghanistan occupation and pull out a year ago, and then see how the country can pull back from the brink. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magner joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Marseille, France. Also joining us will be Frank Emspach. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you both for joining us in this program. Elijah Magner, I'm going to first start with you. We're looking at Afghanistan's one-year anniversary, and let me see what they have called it, the Day of Salvation and Freedom. If they have called it that, natural question, one of them would be, have they been salvaged and freed?
Thank you for having me. At least they were freed from the U.S. occupation that remained in the country for 20 years and occupied the country to liberate Afghanistan from the Taliban and, according to the Doha Agreement carried out by Donald Trump and later on by Joe Biden, gave back the power to the Afghan Taliban once again after 20 years. So what the Americans did is exactly what Julian Assange said, that the Americans were aiming for a long war, not a successful war. What the Americans have done after 20 years of occupation of the country, they basically destroyed the country and left the country with the suspension of the international aid, freezing of access to Afghanistan foreign exchanges reserves, and blocking $9 billion that Joe Biden is withholding on the Afghan population in exchange of course, dictating its own conditions, of which starting with appointing a central bank director that's selected by the Americans. So because of the dire situation in Afghanistan, because of the Americans have destroyed the country and left the country really on the floor, the Afghani today can't really maintain the country and can't survive without foreign aid. Now, there is no foreign aid. It's very little arriving to Afghanistan, nothing to compare of what the Americans and the Europeans are giving to the Ukrainian in their war against Russia. So without an international support, with the security challenges, with the Americans sending drones and assassinating whoever they want, violating the Afghanistan's sovereignty, the situation in Afghanistan 1 year after the withdrawal of the U.S. occupation force is not looking very well.
Well, on this day, Frank Emspach, you have many Afghans that are of the belief that good riddance. They said death to the United States. This day is the day of the victory of truth over falsehood and the day of salvation and freedom of the Afghan nation. Many of them came out and relayed that sentiment. What brings a question that comes about here is, what was the U.S. doing in Afghanistan which saw them required them to stay in that country for 20 years and then pull out when they did?
Well, I think that part of the reason we went into Afghanistan is that we wanted to wreak revenge on the 9/11 destruction, and Afghanistan was a handy target. We weren't going to attack the people who attacked us, Saudi Arabia. All the people who were doing this were Saudis. And they were holed up in what used to be an American base in Afghanistan. So it was a clear target, and it was a chance for the United States to, what we thought, overthrow a weak government and take over. Well, it didn't work out that way. And once you get involved in this kind of thing, a country like ours, or France for that matter, in Africa, and or in Indochina a generation ago, it's hard for the leadership to admit it and say, well, you know, this was not a good idea. And we'll let the Afghanistanis run their own country. So once you're involved, you have this escalating situation, at least here, who lost Afghanistan, and a fear of the government from being attacked by people who claim that it's weak. I think, though, that at this stage of the game, the destruction of the country is what's first and foremost. And I think what we saw here today in this country, that is Saturday, Sunday, and today is Monday, it was extensive coverage of Afghanistan for the first time in almost a year. And what was interesting about it is that some of the coverage actually mentioned that the Taliban were trying to accomplish something, not all favorable, but mentioning that some schools had been reopening. And an interesting thing in the New York Times coverage was the focus on women in medical school there, and that that's still functioning. And so it was, for the first time, not a completely negative series of articles. Now, I was only looking at the Times, the Wall Street Journal, and National Public Radio, so I can't say what happened throughout the rest of the media. Mm-hmm. But at least some recognition that there was something going on there other than just repression. However, there was no real focus on one of the facts that the United States has basically stolen the Afghan treasury and has made things much, much more difficult. There did not seem to be an emphasis, however, on anything like the United States getting ready to try to overthrow the current government, which I thought was a good thing that was not focused, not a focus of the news.
Well, Elijah Magner, I'm trying to put things into perspective over here when it comes to the one-year anniversary and how the Taliban has, I was going to say progressed, but actually hasn't progressed much. So you're looking at a list of factors over here where they have not been recognized by the international community. You're looking at the fact that, for example, the marginalization of minorities, marginalization of women, a ban on secondary education for girls on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have people dying from hunger. There's no work. Unemployment is skyrocketing. And it almost looks as if, not that I'm saying the woman recognition is not very important, or having what the U.S. considers a terrorist to be, I think, the central bank, holding a position in the central bank, as you mentioned. But if you put things into perspective, the country is not doing well. Shouldn't there be more focus on the humanitarian and the economic side of things, as opposed to, well, because they're not letting women come into the workforce and or things that have to do perhaps with the way that women are not given opportunities?
Well, here in the West, the focus mainly on something more exciting, talking only about women's rights and the women going to school or allowed to go to school and university, disregarding the fact that Afghanistan is really starved. According to the looking at Afghanistan from a real perspective, one should look at what are the priorities first. The priorities is not, of course, to undermine minority and to mistreat women and prevent the schooling and university, etc., but first to allow people to survive and eat and be able to stand on their feet and grow in a country that has been devastating by occupation and was not doing well even before the occupation. So what we see today, one thing positive is the drop of civilian casualties since August 2021 that went from 7,000 to 1,000. However, we see increased action of the Islamic State Khorasan that the Americans have contributed not to fight, but to transport from Syria to Afghanistan. So all these disregarding the
why would they do that?
Security. Sorry?
Why would they do that? Why would they transfer the Daesh terrorists from, I think you said, Syria to Afghanistan?
Well, because they were facing Taliban and not managing to face Taliban, so they wanted the enemy of Taliban, because ISIS was in Syria the enemy of everybody, including the extremist Sunnis and Al-Qaeda, and because Al-Qaeda and Taliban are together, so ISIS Khorasan were transferred from northeast Syria into Afghanistan to fight the Taliban. And because the Americans had no real intention to withdraw and they did not have a clear idea when to leave, and we saw how Donald Trump spent several years in negotiating in Doha, and when Joe Biden came, he did not want to leave, and he was mainly forced to leave because he was not expecting Taliban to take Kabul so quickly and wanted the Afghan army to fight for at least 6 months. So this didn't happen. The Americans were taken by surprise. They were forced to abandon the embassy, abandon the city, were caught at the airport, and they had to flee the country. So all that speeded up the delivery of power to Taliban by the same Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, at that time, because he saw how the Americans abandoned him. So now the country is really under financial difficulties, and the Americans are the main factor contributing by freezing $9 billion to a poor country devastated by a war and blocking all this very vital asset to the Afghanis. This is a main contributor, and that is the priority of the Afghan government today, is to feed the population and to look after what's going to happen to the infrastructure. They can't do that.
Well, I mean, you know, Frank Emspach, when you take a look at the Afghans and they're seeing this $9 billion in frozen funds not being returned, you can imagine how they feel about the U.S. after this. Even the ones who perhaps had an admiration for the U.S., I'm sure that has been dented. You're looking at the $9 billion, you're looking at the halting of foreign aid that at some point constituted 80% of Afghanistan's annual budget, if you can believe that. And you said, Frank Emspach, that you thought at one point that maybe the U.S. Was contemplating coming back into Afghanistan. Well, I mean, aren't these actions by the U.S. somewhat a recipe for a country to be choked off to the point where maybe the U.S. does have the intention of perhaps coming back into the country, or at a minimum, making sure that country remains unstable?
I think the minimum making it keep unstable is an objective of some. But not all. I think we have to go back to that 80% business. No country can go with 80% of its budget being paid for by a third party from on August 1st to zero on August 18th and expect that everything's going to be okay. And I think that that's what we did. In addition to that, although, yes, we have allowed some foreign aid, the fact of the matter is all kinds of sanctions are in place. We've made it extremely difficult for other aid agencies and other countries to give money to Afghanistan. The exception seems to be the International Red Cross, who is running about 30 hospitals in Afghanistan at the moment. But the fact of the matter is, if we as Americans or all the people in Western Europe, what we used to call Western Europe, want to deal with this honestly, we have to demand that our governments pay up, you know, support the Afghan government, not decide we're going to let people starve to death because we don't like the Taliban, and recognize that within the Taliban, as was on National Public Radio yesterday, here, you had two leading Taliban people debating each other about, you know, how important the education of women was, high schools, and pointing out that in about a third of the country, the high schools for women are open because the people will not stand for them being closed. And so the NPR correspondent said, gee, you mean that there's all that kind of opposition? And one of the leaders said, it isn't opposition. We have a difference of opinion on that. That's perfectly valid. And a third of the country, he said, we have women in high school. He said, so, yes, we have internal divisions. Now, that, I think, when you can discuss that kind of thing openly on international news, these guys were both leaders in Afghanistan. This is a pretty good thing, it seems to me, and would suggest that if we, the United States, would get our foot off their neck and not continue to assassinate people in the middle of their capital and whatnot, right. and allow politics to grow, we're going to have a much more secular and a much more democratic system than we had there under American rule.
Right.
That should be our objective. And well, the only way that's going to happen, I think, is if American people or the French people say that our governments have to actually be serious in building the country and not making it difficult for the government.
I mean, you know, we could talk about just the $9 billion and form a program out of that. Because if we really think about it, if the U.S. is so concerned about where this money is going to go, why don't they start with $1 billion and see how that's going to go? Forget $1 billion, $500 million. No, seriously, looking at a country that people are dying in there after all this time, and I mean, that country is not doing well. Iran is doing its share of having the refugees come in, you know. But let's move on to the whole Daesh al-Qaeda situation, Elijah Magnier. And I'm not trying to imply anything. I'm really curious as to how that stands. Why, if you think the Taliban could do more to eliminate them, especially coming on the heels of Ayman al-Zawahiri to have been killed by the U.S. forces, which they said they don't need a DNA to have that proven. But regardless, is the Taliban actually doing enough to eradicate it, Daesh, from the country?
Al-Qaeda is not the enemy of Taliban and vice versa. So the Taliban never had the intention to eliminate Al-Qaeda. On the contrary, they offer shelter to Al-Qaeda, but they didn't want Al-Qaeda to carry out operation or terrorist attacks against other countries starting from Afghanistan. That was the main problem between the Taliban and the Americans, because the Taliban refused to deliver Al-Qaeda leaders to the Americans. Now, when Ayman al-Zawahiri is killed in the middle of Kabul, he was offered a shelter willingly by the Taliban government, and the Americans were not very much foreign to what Al-Qaeda is doing there and to the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And also, I would like to add something else. The Americans negotiated with the Taliban for over 3 to 4 years in the Doha, in Qatar. So they were very much aware that the Taliban were taking the leadership of the country and they will be the next ruler. So if they like it or not, if they didn't want the Taliban, they would not have negotiated with them. When Joe Biden said, I expected the army to last for at least 6 months, because he knew at the end of these 6 months, had the army held its position and fought the Taliban, will give up on the capital to the Taliban. So everybody was aware that the Taliban will take over. Taliban and Al-Qaeda are friends. The only problem is they both have one common enemy, is the ISIS, Khorasan, or the Islamic State. They are not the enemy of the Americans. They said it today, Zabihullah Mujahid said today, we want good relationship with the Americans, and we expected the Americans to stand by their deal and the Doha agreement, which they not. So it is not a question of relationship between Al-Qaeda and Taliban. The Americans collaborated widely with Al-Qaeda in Syria. They supported them. They trained many of Al-Qaeda members under the name of jihadis that we know they are under the Al-Qaeda umbrella. So it has never been a real issue. It is just selective when the Americans want to assassinate an Al-Qaeda leader. Well, they go for that just for domestic reasons and domestic policy.
I was making perhaps a mistake of grouping all of them as Daesh terrorists. Perhaps thank you for breaking that open or breaking that up and explaining the difference there. Amir Khan Mottaki is the acting foreign minister, Frank M. Spack. One of the statements he made on this day is, quote, we want a good relationship with all countries. And then my question to you of what he said, we won't let Afghanistan's territory be used against anyone. Who's going to be using the Afghan territory against another country? And which country or countries is he referring to, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert on all the different organizations that are attacking Pakistan or involved in various activities against Iran or whatever. But I think that the major point that the Afghan government is trying to make here is that they will not tolerate the use of Afghanistani territory as a launching pad for anybody against anybody. And I think that's what they're trying to accomplish, and that they may have other political organizations that are taking shelter there. That's one thing as far as they're concerned. But using Afghanistan as a launching pad is another. They're trying to exert a sovereignty and say that the Afghanis are equal, and people should recognize them as such. And I believe that you're going to see that begin to happen relatively soon. It may not happen with the United States, but we take a look at what we did in Vietnam. It was the same story. All of a sudden, we said, oh, my God, what's happening here? And the Saigon army collapsed in, 2 months, from about January to April, finished, right? And we'd been saying all along in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then instead of following through on the peace plan that we had, there were supposed to be reparations. Remember that? There was supposed to be trade and all that. Forget it for 10 years,
Right.
And so we also did the same thing there as we're doing with Afghanistan. And I think it's really unseemly and hypocritical and the wrong thing for this country to be doing. So we, the United States, can make a major contribution to stability there, should we wish to do so. But it doesn't. That's the case.
Well, unless you're making instability 60 kilometers close to where China's. Final question comes to you, Elijah Magnier. Please explain to us in a short time, 1 minute, if you can, what's going on with the neighbors of Afghanistan, in particular China, Iran, and Pakistan. China is said to, another question is how China actually received the Taliban, it seems like from the get-go, when they took over. It is now said that they are not incurring tariffs on any of the imports that come, anything that goes into the country, and they've actually are somewhat cooperating security with Afghanistan. But regionally, with the regional countries and neighbors, how do you see things going from this point on?
From the first day the Americans completed their withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Kabul, immediately Iran supplied Afghanistan with oil most needed in the country. China rushed to Afghanistan and offered its support because stability in Afghanistan is extremely important, not only for Pakistan, but also for China, even if the borders are not very large, but with Iran as well. And we see many delegations going to Tehran because the security in Afghanistan, stability in Afghanistan is extremely important to maintain the security on the borders and make sure there will not be a flood of Afghani refugees in Iran, as it's actually happening today and in the last year because of the economic situation. So the stability in Afghanistan is very important for the neighboring country and not seemingly important for the Americans who were there for 20 years and were very much aware what kind okay. of security Afghanistan is in need of.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time, but thank you so much. Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin for Madison. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, Journalist and Political Analyst from Marseille, France. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions on theological issues and some doubts that some have on different issues with regard to Islamic issues. Sheikh Anad, before starting our discussion, I would like to welcome you to this show and say salam to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. The question of the day is again about some phrases of Ziyarat of Ashura of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In some parts of this year, we recite that أشهد أنك قد أقمت الصلاة وأتيت الزكاة وأمرت بالمعروف ونهيت عن المنكر. We want to ask the respected Sheikh and guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, on the translation, then interpretation of these words and these phrases. What do we mean by Nahita Anil Munkar? Does it mean that people actually were not performing their duties, their obligations at that time, and Imam came to teach them how to do your obligatory actions? Does it mean so? Or wasn't there a religion by the name of Islam? And so whom he was actually was appointed to, and whom was he going towards to bring the religion for? He was living in Medina in one of the Islamic centers, and then he moved to Mecca, and from there he moved to Kufa, the places that he and his father and his brother were living there, and they were preaching Islam in that time. So what do, let's say, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says and means by these words? And when I'm saying that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because we really believe that this is Hadith Qudsi. Hadith Qudsi is something that has been said by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is not Quran, but this is Hadith. So what happened that, let's say, years after the dawn of the Islam, we see that these phrases come to our mind, that what happened? Wasn't there any religion or any deen by the name of Islam that Imam wanted to do Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, and to tell them what to do and what not to do? And aqamta salat, that you come to actually set up the prayers and to be the protector of the prayer and salat. Wasn't there something by the name of salat at that time?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First point that I have to add, the, you know, ziyara and visitation of Imam Hussein, which contain these part of the, you know, at, let's say, visitation of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, this is not Hadith Qudsi. But after all, we have this phrase that أشهد أنك قد أغمت الصلاة وآتيت الذكاء. You know, I witnessed that you established the prayer